Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Reader Payne about his book, War and Diplomacy in the Napoleonic Era, Sir Charles Stuart, Castlereagh, and the Balance of Power in Europe. Reader, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thanks for being on our show. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Yes, I'm currently employed as a heritage consultant, and I'm also got a passion for sort of late 18th, early 19th century history. I did my PhD, 12 years ago, looking at Pitt the Younger and Lord North. Of course, Lord North, a particular figure in United States history. And for some time, I've been wanting to sort of, you know, write a project on the Napoleonic War. So that's kind of, you know, I've kind of been holding down a job as I say, my daytime job, which is to advise various clients on historic buildings and landscapes, and my other job, which is basically writing Napoleonic history.
What led you to focus on Sir Charles Stuart as your first subject in Napoleonic history?
I've long been interested in Lord Castlereagh's tenures at the Foreign Office, because, you know, he's obviously seen as a very European kind of statesman, sometimes quite out of sort of the ordinary of his time. And I always was intrigued by his brother, who has some really key positions in the period. And it's always tends to be written off as pure nepotism. You know, he's famous for sort of fighting people and famous for sort of picking fights with all sorts of individuals. And I thought, well, there must be more to the man than that. I spent a lot of my academic career looking at the workings of patronage in the Hanoverian period, where, you know, basically, to us, it may seem like nepotism, but, you know, obviously it's the way the system worked in the 18th and 19th centuries. And I've often been quite sort of passionate to sort of see, you know, to go against these ideas of people being given posts simply because of who they are. So obviously the narrative had always been that Stuart got these plum positions in the military and the civilian spheres simply because he was Lord Castlereagh's brother. Obviously that played an important part. But I really wanted to see what made Stuart the man. What, you know, was he up to his job? Was he basically, you know, what was he deserving of Castlereagh's patronage? So again, it was really a kind of trying to bring Stuart to life as an individual and to understand why he was such a key figure in not only Britain's military history in the peninsula, but basically was at the heart of Britain's diplomacy for a decade.
I have to say, I mean, you succeeded for me, at least, in terms of doing that, because as I was reading, I'm thinking, I'm surprised that we don't have more written about him, given the life you describe. I mean, it was one that was at the heart of power for a very critical period in European history. But it was also fascinating to lead this dramatic life, how he, you know, he slept around. It was a very dashing life in a lot of ways. It was the kind of thing I think, especially when I compare it to his brother, who was an incredibly important figure, but didn't have quite that same amount of brio in his life that Charles had.
I think that's very true, and I think that the one thing that, what, without sort of prejudging where we're going in the book. I think the problem has been that when he died, there were so few people around who actually remembered his glorious career. you know, we're talking, you know, well into the Victorian period when he actually died, and the sort of first biography didn't come out until, well, the first and only biography didn't come out until the 1860s. So there were literally a handful of people who may have remembered his career. But I think as the Victorian period went on, as the 20th century went on, that it was Castlereagh who was always remembered. And you find that Stuart literally becomes no more than a footnote. It's kind of just, oh, yeah, that's Castlereagh's brother. He was ambassador to Austria, minister to Prussia, full stop. So I think in many ways that he, you know, perhaps not lives too long, but because he's out of public life for over 30 years when he returns back from Vienna in 1823, that he's just forgotten about, that he's basically much remembered in this country now as a sort of reactionary Tory who seems to oppose all kinds of reforms.
Well, we'll definitely get to that last part of his life a little bit later on, but I was wondering if you could start us off by talking a bit more about his early years. Who was Charles Stuart? Where was his family from, and where does he fit within the Stuart family tree, shall we say?
Yeah. So the Stuart family by the 18th century had really risen themselves up into the sort of ranks of the Ulster gentry. And then by sort of the later 18th century had managed to get themselves into the ranks of the Irish aristocracy when Stuart's father was made first Baron Londonderry. He then became first Viscount Castlereagh and then first Earl of Londonderry in the 1790s. Stuart is the basically the eldest son of the first Lord Londonderry's second marriage. So he's Castlereagh's half brother, but there's Castlereagh's born in 1769 and Stuart's born in 1778. There's quite an age difference between the two. And what's interesting about this period of the Stuart family history is that both Castlereagh and his brother were educated in Anglican establishments. So obviously, as I'm sure you're aware, you know, many of the families in Ulster were Scottish ancestry. They were Presbyterians. But you find that the Stuart family at this time is taking pains to really sort of manoeuvre themselves to take a position in the Irish and British political establishments where you would be expected to be Anglican, to be a member of that establishment. So Stuart, for example, is sent off to Eton College, you know, which is, we don't get much more Anglican than that, Anglican English school, to sort of cement their position really as members of this sort of new, of this, you know, members of the elite. And then we find that Stuart then passionately wants a military career and basically heads off at 16 off to Central Europe. Sorry, I beg your pardon, off to mainland Europe to fight the French, something which he will, you know, dominate the sort of the first few decades of his life. And it's quite an amazing child. You know, literally, he goes straight out of school and straight into the military, and he still suffers two severe injuries very quickly. And then he then comes back to Britain. He settles down. He marries, becomes an aide-de-camp to King George III. And he's very much, you know, before the Peninsular War. And apologies for the police siren. he's very much, before the Peninsular War, a fairly successful younger son of the first Earl of Londonderry. So he's basically, you know, he ends up being in the War Office. He's an MP. He's married. He's got a son. And what's quite interesting, because Lord and Lady Castlereagh don't have children, he's very much seen, obviously, as the future of the Londonderry title. So he basically, I think before he goes off to the Peninsular War in 1808, he's already recognised as the heir to Londonderry title and estates. So that's kind of his background as I would say, takes on a grander stage, on a more international sort of background.
I'd like to unpack that early military career just a little bit more, because it was interesting, because what you describe, it's on one level seems to be a bit of a conundrum, is that you have Castlereagh, who's, you know, very oriented towards a political career. He's in the Irish Parliament. He plays a central role in getting the Act of Union passed. And yet his younger brother gravitates instead towards the military. And obviously this is a very critical time to be in the military. You have the Revolutionary Wars on the continent. You have the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte at the end of the century and the wars there. What drew Charles to a military career instead of a political career? And how does that end up shaping his subsequent public life in the 18-teens and into the 1820s?
Well, I suspect it's more to do with Charles Stuart's temperament. I don't think he's the cool, rational politician. Whereas Castlereagh, you know, is very much a sort of, you know, very cool, very rational, very, very skillful politician. I think Stuart is a man who basically does not hide his emotions very well. And I think his temperament is really one, he's always wants to dash off and fight people. So I think it fits him temperament very well. But you're right. What's very interesting as well is that Stuart obviously starts off as in his military career. He's potentially talks to his father about going off to Cambridge University if peace should break out between France and Britain in the 1790s. Obviously, there are peace fears between the two countries in the 1790s. Obviously, that never happens. And I think Stuart regrets not going to university actually later on in life. So I think he would have liked to have followed his elder brother Castlereagh in going to Cambridge. But you're right. He makes a transition as well to almost a political figure as well. So it's interesting that although he's very active in the French Revolutionary Wars, when sort of the Peace of Amiens happens and obviously the Napoleonic Wars break out fairly soon after that, Stuart actually doesn't get involved in this. His career takes a very different turn. So he's an MP. He's an MP in Westminster following the Act of Union. He gets his court position as ADC to George III. He marries, he settles down, and he even writes a book on military reform in 1805. So I wonder myself whether he sees himself perhaps under his family influence as developing a more sort of civilian like character by the sort of in the 1800s, and I wonder if the Peninsular War had not actually broken out in the way it did, whether he would have continued in that civilian career, and as I say, forged a successful career, you know, as a fairly, you know, fairly successful younger son of an Irish earl, who is seen as saying is the heir to the titles and the estate. So it's interesting that he spends his early formative years really involved in some quite vicious actions against the French. He's injured twice, for example. You know, I think he's 18 when basically a musket ball goes through his telescope and basically almost blinds him in one eye, and for the rest of his life he's actually, you know, he has that disfigurement, and is actually people comment on the one eye. I think one French guest calls him, you know, that sort of moist sentimental look in his eye, you know, because it gives him the sort of appearance of a hero in later life. So I do wonder if he hadn't been sent out to the Peninsula in 1808, whether actually he would have continued that very successful Anglo-Irish political career, but obviously events intervened to change him on a different course of life.
I was wondering if we could turn to that Peninsular War experience, which you know is such an important part of his life. And it seems, from reading your book, in many ways it seemed to be the highlight of his life in so many ways. If you could perhaps explain what was going on with the Peninsular War in 1808 and 1809. And then how the role that Charles Stuart begins to play at that point, and how he responds basically to the events that surrounding him.
Yes, of course. I suppose people always think of Britain's naval traditions during the Napoleonic Wars, because obviously, you know, the era of Nelson and the great era of successfully defeating the French at sea. It's so different on land, because, you know, Britain may be, you know, almost the master of the seas around the world, which obviously can make sure that Britain can maintain its trade and its empire. But on land, it's quite meagre military resources. So they tend to be used sparingly and in some pretty disastrous campaigns. So on the eve of the Peninsular War, you've got, you know, a history almost of Britain doing brilliantly at sea, but pretty appallingly on the land. And I suppose that may resonate with sort of American viewers about sort of Britain's efforts during the American Revolutionary Wars. But by 1808, what Napoleon, I think, makes the first of his catastrophic mistakes. He is unhappy with the Iberian Peninsula, and is particularly unhappy with his allies, the Bourbons of Spain. So he catches this plan hatched that basically that Spain and France will basically go and invade Portugal, because Portugal is seen as Britain's oldest ally. It's had a treaty with England since the 14th century, and the Prince Regent of Portugal is very keen not to alienate Britain, but also tries to play off the French as well. That doesn't succeed, and the French basically decide to invade Portugal. Now that is the start of a catastrophic French intervention in the peninsula, because the Portuguese royal family are able to escape with British naval help, and off they go to Portugal, where they then run a court in exile. And then basically, because Napoleon is so unimpressed with how Spain has performed as an ally, he then decides to basically depose the Bourbons completely. So basically both Carlos IV and Fernando VII are brought into French territory and basically told that their reign is over, and Joseph Bonaparte will be the new king of Spain. So that doesn't go down too well in Spain itself. And obviously the most famous sort of, you know, outbreak of violence is the Dos de Mayo in Madrid, which obviously is portrayed by Goya, that famous execution scene. And we have basically the civilian population of Madrid, you know, fighting French troops in the capital, and then the French basically having savage reprisals in response. So both sort of outbreaks of rebellion against French rule in both Spain and Portugal lead to a new sort of optimism in London that basically they can intervene somehow militarily against France on mainland Europe. And so both Spanish and Portuguese delegations actually come and ask for help. Spanish only want arms and supplies at this stage, but the Portuguese are pretty keen for some sort of intervention. So what we get is the start of basically a British military intervention in the Iberian Peninsula at the start of 1808. Now, Stuart, he's basically busy at his desk in the War Office, where he's been appointed since 1807. And then he gets the call up as well, because basically, obviously, he's a very well-connected person, and he gets a call up to basically go and lead Hussar brigades in the new campaign to come. So what's interesting, that as soon as he's appointed, he gets lots of letters from various military individuals with their ideas for the campaign. And Stuart himself is not afraid of lobbying his brother, who this time is the war secretary, on how Britain can basically, you know, intervene in the affairs of Portugal and Spain. So he's sent out with the Hussar brigades under the command of Sir John Moore, who they arrive, you know, a few days after sort of a great victory. So it's an interesting time in the peninsula. He's literally there at the start of British intervention, an intervention which will, as we know, will go on for some considerable time, with a drain of resources.
Did he do well as a soldier? Did he distinguish himself? And what were his relations like, both with Moore and with Arthur Wellesley? Because you have this interesting undercurrent in your book about how he has this relationship with Wellington that continues past his military career into his years in the diplomatic service.
Yes, it's an interesting relationship he has with both John Moore and, as you say, with Wellington. With John Moore, I think the problem from the outset is that John Moore is not really trusted by the government that much, and there's not that warmth between Castlereagh and John Moore that there is between Castlereagh, for example, and then Arthur Wellesley. And John Moore is because he's not trusted, you know, that Stuart, I think, does not have too many compunctions about basically writing home to Castlereagh to say exactly what he thinks about him. And as you observe in the book, there's some quite frank letters sent home from a subordinate officer about his commanding officer to the war secretary, basically saying exactly what he thinks of John Moore and of his fitness to command. So there's a lot of tension there. And I think Moore is well aware of what Stuart is up to. And I'm sure Sir John Moore must have been quite wary of Stuart's obviously very, very sort of grand connections back home to the political establishment in London, which must have made him always keep one eye over his shoulder, I expect. Because you can imagine, you know, you're one of your subordinate officers is basically the brother of the man who's basically in charge of the War Office. That's going to make you feel a bit nervous. But Stuart does very well in the first campaign. So obviously this ends with John Moore's death at La Coruna in January 1809. But Stuart comes home very much with fresh laurels. He's involved in some quite severe cavalry clashes, and he's seen as having done his duty very well. So he's a natural, really, to be sent out again when Wellesley is sent out for the definitive Peninsular campaign from 1809 onwards. And it's quite interesting that there's quite a warmth between Arthur Wellesley and Charles Stuart, which, as you say, doesn't necessarily maintain for the rest of their life. And what is interesting is that Arthur Wellesley's career was nearly destroyed by the sort of Convention of Cintra when the French were allowed to evacuate Portugal on Royal Naval ships. What is interesting that reading the letters is that Charles Stuart actually sends home some early reports about that convention to his brother, basically saying it's not Wellesley's fault, it's basically everyone else's fault. And I think that's something that hadn't really come out before, that Stuart had really done his best to try and shield Wellesley as much as possible. And so in 1809, I do feel that there's a real warmth between Wellesley and, you know, as Wellington as he soon became, and Stuart, that possibly does not, is slightly soured a bit by their 4 years in the peninsula together, because Stuart is quite desperate, I think, to become an independent cavalry commander rather than Wellington's adjutant general, which he serves in from 1809 to 12, as basically sort of sorting out paperwork and administrative affairs and things like sort of spying operations. So quite vital operations. It seems to me from his letters home that Stuart begins to wary a bit of Wellington's style of command. He feels that he's not taken into Wellington's confidences. He's not, part of an inner circle. He may be, a general officer, but he's not, part of the decision making, of around the inner sanctum. So, I think by the end of his period in the peninsula, I think he's come to be not personally wary of Wellington, but a bit wary of Wellington's, of how he thinks he's been sidelined in his military career, because at one stage he's even offered the command of the entire Portuguese cavalry, and he ends up turning that down, I suspect, probably because Wellington and his brother told him to, rather than any inclination of his own, because basically he always wants to go off and fight people in the peninsula, and that doesn't tally with his job, which is a really important administrative job back at headquarters. And I think that's almost a metaphor for his entire life. He's got responsibilities, but he always wants to go off on a horse and fight people.
And that's what I find so fascinating about his transition into diplomatic service, because at this point you've described in the book a person who is very much of, maybe to this glamorous up a bit more than might be the case, but he's a warrior. He's a person who really thrills in the participation in warfare. He wants to be fighting, as you've described, and yet he then goes and serves as an ambassador. Why does he shift into the diplomatic service? What is it? His brother's influence? Is it because his relations with Wellington have deteriorated to the point where he is ready to be done with the peninsula? What's driving this rather, on the surface at least, this very unlikely shift?
Yes, it's a radical change, isn't it?
Yes. Although not so radical as you point out later on, because, he's still very much involved in the Napoleonic Wars, just in a different, in a very different way.
In a different way. So he comes back from the peninsula in 1812. His first wife, Catherine Stuart, dies after a minor operation. And I think after that, I think he's almost incapable of carrying on. I think he possibly hasn't thought too much about his family when he's off galloping and fighting people. But I think her death brings home the fact that he has actually basically neglected her. He's seen, since he's been off in Portugal and Spain from 1808, he's barely been home. He comes home once on sick leave, but apart from that, he's basically always away. And I think he feels, a sort of sense of loss and guilt over what he's done to some extent, and he goes very quiet. He comes back to Britain in 1812, but he doesn't go out to Prussia until the spring of 1813. So there's a gap there where there's not much going on. There are very few letters. There's the odd letter between him and Wellington, where Wellington says, "Don't even think of coming back out until you're fully recovered." So, you do wonder what state his health was in, during in that year when he was convalescing at home, I think. And also, I think you're right. I think you've touched a point there about Wellington, that I think he probably realised that Wellington was not going to give him an independent cavalry command. I think deep down, Wellington didn't overly trust him. I think to be a calm senior leader, because, you know, it's that idea that, again, he always wants to go off and fight people, which in a cavalry commander can be quite a dangerous thing. If you basically always want to go and charge people, you might end up sort of being caught in a French rear guard or something. So it's quite a dangerous thing to be too hot-headed as a cavalry commander, because cavalry charges can be quite difficult to control at the best of times. So I think that Castlereagh really wants to find a new kind of role for his brother, and it coincides with the new era of British alliances, which come about after Napoleon's disastrous invasion of Russia. So we have a new alliance with the Russian Empire, which comes about after the declaration of war, and we also then have a declaration of war by Prussia at the end of 1812. Needing a new British representative to that court as well. Now, I think the important thing is that it's not a standard diplomatic posting. It's to be minister to Prussia and ambassador to Russia. Both diplomats were in fact soldiers, and I think it makes sense because it's not. I think, as I said, it's not a grand posting to the Berlin embassy. It's basically attending the King of Prussia on the battlefield and across basically, you know, Central and Western Europe. And I think at one stage, Stuart even offers the Berlin embassy as a residence for someone to actually stay in if they were in Berlin, because clearly he's not using it at all. So I think in many ways he is the correct person to be there, because he does have that sort of, you know, he's used to living in a military world. He's used to traveling with military camps. And I think there is also a sort of martial military air around the Prussian and Russian sovereigns at this time. And I think it's quite interesting that when he's first presented to the King of Prussia, Friedrich Wilhelm III, that he's complimented on his military exploits. And I think that's actually I think he's the right person to be there at the time. But as you say, it's not, you know, if it was a standard diplomatic post, I suspect he would have been a very bad choice.
You describe him, sometimes he's chafing at the bit to go back into military command. And you even describe how occasionally he is given military responsibilities with the Prussian cavalry, which I thought was really surprising.
Yes, at the Battle of Leipzig, he's basically given command of a regiment of the Brandenburg Hussars by General Blücher. It's an incredible idea to think that the French... The French batteries at Leipzig would have had no idea that basically the Prussian cavalry is being led by the British minister. It's absolutely mad, really. And there are other times when Stuart, you know, charges at various things. He gets a splinter wound at an earlier battle, I think in August 1813. His fellow ambassador, Lord Cathcart, who is ambassador to Russia, basically takes charges of the Tsar's batteries of artillery at another occasion as well. So it really is this kind of military martial atmosphere, you know, amongst amongst the whole sort of headquarters. And I think the problem is that tends to cloud people's opinions of Stuart as minister to Prussia, that he's out of his depth. He's a stupid soldier, always happy to go and fight people. Now, yes, he's certainly happy to always go and fight people, but quite often he's the right person to be there, because he quickly gets the measure of all sorts of underhand diplomacy going on, especially, you know, as all sorts of sort of conditions, all sorts of sort of schemes to try and save Napoleon's throne, especially, for example, Metternich, who seems to be quite keen to sort of keep the Bonapartes in power. I'm sure completely disconnected to the fact there's a Habsburg Empress as well in Paris. I'm sure that's not connected whatsoever. It's he's quite often very blunt, yes, but there's an incident where the Earl of Aberdeen, who's appointed ambassador to Austria, is negotiating potentially Britain's maritime rights. You know, no British government would ever negotiate that, because basically, again, that's the whole basis of British trade and imperial power, is its mastery of the seas. So basically, you know, Aberdeen, who I think, you know, is only in his 20s, he's an earl, he's very well connected, I think sometimes gets convinced of his own cleverness and superiority, you know, sort of says, oh, I've done, you know, I've arranged all this diplomacy. And then Stuart comes along, basically sees what's happening and said, this is all rubbish, we're not having this nonsense. And then Paul Aberdeen has to go to Metternich and the Tsar and basically say, oh dear, sorry, we've got to forget all this. So being the blunt soldier quite often is absolutely spot on in 1813-14 when a civilian diplomat not used to the military rigors of campaign to death as well, because Aberdeen famously comes across a battlefield and is just horrified by the sight of corpses. You know, as you would expect, someone who's lived his life as a civilian scholar and a friend of Pitt the Younger suddenly sees a battlefield. It's, you know, we can't comprehend really that a difference in the world. So I think Stuart literally was, you know, spot on for this post as minister to Prussia. And I think when he's able to, for example, keep Sweden on side, where Sweden's looking a bit wobbly at times because of obviously Bernadotte's preoccupations with other things, he's not afraid to tell Bernadotte, who's Crown Prince of Sweden, to his face what he thinks of his actions. That takes a lot of courage to do that. And I think, you know, being the rash, brave soldier, probably helped by having Castlereagh's full support, because Castlereagh's been Foreign Secretary since 1812, is a help. And I think he knows, you know, that he can probably get away with things other diplomats might not be able to get away with.
So is his promotion to the Vienna embassy a reflection of his success? Is it because was he just simply the available person for the job? Or was it because his brother wanted to have that someone there that he knew he could trust more than practically any other person at his disposal?
Yeah, I think actually it's a combination of all of those things. Because interesting, you say Castlereagh becomes Foreign Secretary in 1812. He sends his brother out to Prussia in 1813. So I suspect obviously Castlereagh could use that patronage at his disposal. When the first abdication of Napoleon is secured, obviously there's a riot of celebrations across Europe and in London. And Stuart is very much seen, you know, as having done a really good job. So he's raised to the House of Lords, you know, becomes Lord Stuart in 1814. That's quite a massive promotion. That's a huge honour for a younger son. He's done really well to get that, and only still in his 30s. But I think the problem is that he's, you know, I don't know what would have happened to him in 1814, because even his father writes to Castlereagh to say, have you heard from Charles? Do you know what he's actually going to do with himself? Because technically, you know, he don't know. He's technically unemployed. So he's back in London, but he's not actually doing anything. So I think when Lord Aberdeen decides that he's not returned to diplomacy, he decides, you know, basically a year is quite enough for him, that Castlereagh is left with kind of, well, who do we send? Because it's going to be a really important post. It's going to be key to the conquest of Vienna delegation. And I think you're right. I think he sees Stuart as having done a good job in Prussia, that, you know, he's sort of person he can trust implicitly in Vienna, because it's going to be a key diplomatic, decision, because basically anything that happens in Vienna is going to decide the future map, the future states, the future status of Europe. So I think he's available. The post comes up unexpectedly, and Stuart basically, is completely trustworthy. And I think, you know, there's always that relationship that Castlereagh and Stuart swapped some very frank letters about European diplomacy in a way, again, I don't think many other diplomats could do so, because, you know, you've got, you know, a key warm relationship with Britain's leading statesman that no other diplomat really enjoys.
So Stuart is appointed to Vienna, and he's appointed at, you know, quite possibly the most critical point in over a century and a half, and quite possibly ever since, in terms of this embassy, during the Congress of Vienna. What was Stuart's role in the Congress of Vienna, and what were his experiences with it like?
Well, again, we get a popular stereotype of Stuart in Vienna, because he's very much one of the more colourful characters in a very colourful Congress. So as you'll recall from the book, he ends up basically starting a fistfight in the street with a Viennese coachman. He gets up to all sorts of, you know, outrageous stuff at the opera. He puts on lots of expensive entertainments. He amuses everyone. And that's kind of the Stuart that makes it into the history books, because obviously if you're writing a general history of the Congress, you want to bring out the colourful aspects. So obviously you can't get away from that. And I think that for me as a historian, that's actually quite a difficult thing to deal with, because it's really Stuart often acts crassly. He acts, you know, he acts, you know, in a sort of sexist way. He's often drunk, and it's hard really to sort of square that with the serious diplomat. So that was quite a challenging part of the book for me, to try and say, actually, there is more to Stuart at the Congress of Vienna than basically the loudmouth, rude, sexist diplomat. And you find that Castlereagh is using him for all sorts of sort of little missions. For example, when there are the troubles over a new Romanov Kingdom of Poland, obviously everyone's worried that war might break out, because a lot of the Western powers don't want to see Russia in Poland, see her borders expanded further to the west. So Stuart is sent on a sort of mission to the Emperor Alexander to talk about sort of Russian ambitions. He's also sent to basically talk with Prince Talleyrand, who heads the French mission, to talk about sort of, you know, warmer alliances between sort of Britain and France. And he's also seen as another middleman between Castlereagh and Metternich as well. So he's very much kind of used by his brothers as a sort of trusted eyes and ears throughout the entire Congress. And he can also do things that perhaps Castlereagh can't do. So it's interesting when the Austrian spy networks, who have a great time with Stuart, they love following him and detailing all his sort of sexual encounters, how much champagne he drinks, how many people he's punched in the street that day. I mean, they have a great time, because I think the files on his brother basically say something like Lord and Lady Castlereagh were seen today looking at some shops. End of report. So the Austrian spy who gets to follow Stuart has to have great time. I imagine the Austrian spy following Castlereagh is quite bored most of the time. Poor chap. But you see the Austrians soon realise that Stuart, for example, is a regular visitor to the French diplomatic mission. And obviously, Britain and France are allies now since the restoration of Louis XVIII. But it's still going to be some, you know, undoubtedly residual wariness, especially, for example, on the part of France towards Britain. So Talleyrand still has quite a suspicious sort of nature about British diplomatic intentions towards France. And it's interesting that Stuart is regularly seen at the French embassy. And I think that it's almost certain that he must have been trying to ease those relations and try and basically ease any tension between Castlereagh and Talleyrand. Because obviously, you know, having an alliance with France turns out to be quite important as the sort of European situation deteriorates, and there's obviously threats and worries in 1815 about war with Russia and then Prussia over not only the new Polish kingdom, but then the extinction of the Kingdom of Saxony, which had made the mistake of staying Napoleonic, and then poor Saxony ends up being sort of reduced by a third as for its pain. So I can see Stuart is able to do things that Castlereagh can't necessarily do. But of course, to anyone who Stuart actually meets, they would know he's Castlereagh's brother. And basically, he would speak with the foreign secretary's absolute and full confidence and orders. So I think he does play a really key role. But as I say, as a historian, it's really difficult to balance that with that crass nature that Stuart really shows to the fore at the Congress of Vienna. I mean, in a way that he doesn't really before or after. So it was a very difficult couple of chapters to write.
So you have him playing this role in the Congress of Vienna. Of course, he's there when Napoleon stages his dramatic return and inaugurates what ends up becoming the Hundred Days. Does Stuart play a role in those events, or is he on the sidelines?
No, he's very much actually key to these whole events. You know, he's one of the first sort of diplomats to actually find out about Napoleon's return, because another British consul basically writes to another British diplomat, who then writes immediately to Stuart. So he knows pretty early on, and he's able to really keep his brother informed of what's going on amongst the Allies, because obviously there's always, I think, a worry on Britain's side about, you know, would there be a separate peace with Napoleon? Would the Austrians, for example, play a more subtle game? One of the things that Stuart teases out quite a lot is that Metternich's attitude towards a Napoleonic restoration is not as clear-cut as it could be. So he worries, for example, Stuart worries very much that Metternich has got his eye on not Napoleon I, but Napoleon II assuming power in France, under the regency of Marie-Louise, obviously, who's a Habsburg archduchess. And then Stuart says, of course, it wouldn't be Marie-Louise who would rule France, it would be Metternich who would rule France through her. So there's lots of British paranoia about what might happen. So, yes, he's very much able to send regular reports to his brother. The military man comes out again because, obviously, everyone's attention turns to the military campaign. He's able to advise his brother on Prussian hostility towards the Duke of Wellington. He's able to advise on sort of Allied troop numbers and basically the sort of condition of the troops in question. And then he's basically sent off to march with Allied headquarters. So basically the sovereigns of Austria, Russia and Prussia who are advancing from Paris from the east in what's the sort of obviously everyone's attention focuses on Wellington, the Prussians and the Waterloo, the Battle of Waterloo. But Stuart is actually with this massive force which travels west from Vienna and invades France as well, from the east. Although, unfortunately, I think Castlereagh gets a little bit annoyed that Stuart doesn't take himself off very quickly because he's too busy enjoying the champagne fueled charms of his then current mistress, the Duchess of Sagan. And then he basically says, actually, and the Congress of Vienna is due to be signed tomorrow. So he says to his brother, I may as well stay in Vienna and sign it. It makes sense, really. So, he sometimes bends the rules as much as he possibly can. Again, because he's Castlereagh's brother, he gets away with it. But then, he's able to report on the military campaign, from Vienna, traveling east into France. So traveling west into France. And, he plays a key role here. For example, he's able to report on sort of French peace feelers just after the Battle of Waterloo, and he reports that back to his brother. He also reports on various, military sort of clashes still going on well after the Battle of Waterloo, in fact, because there are pockets of French resistance still, as late as July 1815. So, he is centre stage, really, as sort of the British representative in that campaign, that Eastern campaign, which tends to get overshadowed, perhaps in British historiography, and understandably so sometimes, by the Anglo-Prussian and other Allied campaigns, which ends at Waterloo.
So he is there for the signing of the peace, and he remains in the embassy afterward, which means he's at the heart of the post-Congress diplomacy. I was wondering if you could perhaps briefly explain what was going on in Europe diplomatically, and then perhaps elaborate a bit upon Stuart's role in it. Was he advancing British interests? Was he participating in a lot of the consultations that were taking place? And what were some of the key issues that arose during this period that he had to address?
Yeah, it's a very interesting period. The post-Napoleonic period really is one, certainly from the British diplomatic point of view, it's one of key interest in what goes on in the affairs of mainland Europe. And Castlereagh sends a memorandum at the beginning of 1816, basically telling senior British diplomats and ministers that they should be, really involved in the affairs of their respective courts and send information back to London. There's a real feeling that Britain is actively engaged in mainland European affairs, and it's not just a sort of slightly off power, across the channel. And there's all sorts of issues that need to be dealt with. There's some sort of territorial arrangements that need to be sorted out. There's the future, obviously, of the Kingdom of France, its reparations immediately in 1815. And there's all sorts of things that break out as well. There's trouble in Spain's South American colonies. There's issues, with various issues of slavery, of course, which Britain is very interested in. Britain's obviously very, very keen on pushing a sort of abolitionist agenda, not surprisingly. And there are also, perhaps from sort of the late 1810s onwards, a sort of increasing paranoia amongst European statesmen about the threat of revolution as well. So it never really goes, the danger of revolution never really goes away, despite the second restoration of Louis XVIII in 1815. The there's always France tends to dominate European thought that's the entire time. So at the Congress of Aix-la-Chapelle, where Stuart attends as a full delegate in 1818, the main issue is the withdrawal of Allied occupation troops from France, which are under the command of the Duke of Wellington. But also underlying that, there's lots of offhand diplomatic notes that Stuart sends back to London on Austrian not paranoia, but Austrian concerns about the future of the French monarchy. That Louis XVIII is seen as, you know, as stable the second time around, but there's lots of concerns really about Louis XVIII's brother, the Comte d'Artois, who's seen as a sort of bastion of ultra royalism, and sort of, you know, a very right wing view of French monarchical traditions, whereas France obviously needs a bit of stability, a bit of moderation. So there's huge worries about the future of France really from sort of the late 1810s onwards, and then when you get revolutions breaking out in Spain and Naples, there are concerns again about could a new revolutionary spirit basically dominate, you know, Western Europe as it did, you know, from 1789 to 1793 with France. So there's always that paranoia, but there's, again, that runs side by side with the European congresses where statesmen meet together quite regularly. And as I say, for a British diplomatic story like myself, it's a really interesting period where Britain really is seen as a key European power in a way that perhaps Britain, you know, is rather withdraws from after Castlereagh's death. I don't want to get too far ahead there. So I think Stuart plays a key part. He's basically sending huge memorandums back to his brother in London about Europe, you know, about different European powers. He often meets other European diplomats in Vienna. He, you know, often meets with European sovereigns. For example, when the Emperor Alexander comes to Vienna, he basically meets with him and has several interviews. He meets all these people at the congresses as well. For example, the Congress of Aix-la-Chapelle, he actually invites the painter Sir Thomas Lawrence out, who then paints some of his famous sets of Napoleonic military heroes and statesmen, and even takes the opportunity to have a talk with the Tsar while he's actually sitting to Lawrence for a portrait. So, you know, he's really, really involved in all of this great power diplomacy throughout the entire 1810s and early 1820s. And he really is absolutely centre stage. And he puts Vienna, I think, as you said a moment ago, he puts Vienna absolutely centre stage at Britain's diplomatic efforts in a way that, again, perhaps the Vienna embassy hasn't enjoyed before or since.
You describe a lot of his role in a lot of international events, but you also describe this his role in this very domestic drama, you know, very literally domestic drama, in terms of the Prince Regent and his efforts to divorce his wife, Charlotte. I was wondering if you could explain what was going on there and what was Stuart trying to do and how it turned out for him.
Yes, obviously the then Prince of Wales's marriage to Caroline of Brunswick was an unmitigated disaster from the start. Basically, I think famously he called for drink on his first meeting, and then she just commented he thought he was rather fatter than his portraits. I'm sure portrait painters wouldn't dare flatter the Prince of Wales. So it just went badly from there. The problem was they couldn't stand one another. I think the Prince of Wales married her to get more cash out of his dad, George III, a perennial issue between the two men. And so basically when Europe was reopened again to British travellers, I think everyone just wanted Caroline to go away. So the British government said, basically, here's some cash, please go away. And I think everyone hoped she wouldn't come back. Now, the problem for Stuart is that Caroline decided that she would settle in the Austrian territories in Italy. So anything that she did would immediately, you know, interest him as ambassador to the Austrian Empire. So we get some very early on when Stuart is in Milan traveling with the imperial court, that he starts to hear rumors about Caroline's lifestyle with an Italian called Bartolomeo Pergami, who he calls Bergami in the English edition of always mispronouncing people's names. It's the same thing at the refusal to call Napoleon Napoleon. It's always Bonaparte or Bonaparte. So the English and British are very keen to sort of do this sort of thing. So he hears these first reports about Caroline's behaviour with this Italian who comes into the princess's household, and Stuart's quite horrified by this. Not only to a British aristocrat is he foreign. He's also low born. So it's absolutely appalling, that he's actually involved with the Princess of Wales. It becomes clear pretty early on that the two of them are probably having, an affair, basically, which is understandable. She's not particularly loved. She's living in a foreign country, and the Prince Regent is hardly discreet about his own affairs either. But the problem is that, technically speaking, for a Princess of Wales to commit adultery is high treason. Because obviously that disputes the future heir to the crown. So no one's actually thinking of putting on trial for high treason, but the regent senses an opportunity to get rid of her once and for all. And so Stuart ends up becoming a linchpin of a becomes quite an elaborate spying operation against the Princess of Wales. So you've got a very strange mixture of Stuart's careers. As he's doing high European diplomacy, he's also collecting what's called in Foreign Office memo speak, disgusting scandal. And unfortunately, you quite often find the Foreign Office memo is there, but the disgusting scandal's been removed from the file. So that's quite annoying, actually, when you actually really want to read about the disgusting scandal. And we hear, he's collecting informants. Someone called the painter is one informant. He basically, he's collecting all sorts of information. Then he then sends off his secretary off to Milan to basically start collecting as well this information. And Stuart really trades on his relationship with Metternich and the Austrians to push them into provide as much help as they possibly can. But the Austrians, in return, don't want to be involved. They really don't want to be involved in what's a family scandal, even though it's a royal family scandal. And poor Stuart, his peace of mind is quite interrupted when Caroline actually turns up at the Vienna embassy itself in 1817. And so basically he decides to go on a holiday and take the entire staff with him. So poor, there's a cartoon of Caroline turning up in Vienna, and basically there's no one there to greet her. There's a minor diplomat is left in charge. But of course, it's an insult to basically not greet the Princess of Wales on her arrival in a foreign capital. And taking their cue, the Imperial Court then also say, actually, we're a bit busy too. Sorry, we can't really receive you. Apologies. Enjoy your stay in Vienna, though. And as the whole process gets more elaborate when Princess Charlotte of Wales dies in childbirth. So obviously, she's the only child of the regent and the Princess of Wales. And once she dies, I think the gloves are really, truly off. And the regent basically is desperate to be rid of Caroline. And then Stuart, has to then, move up a gear into really organising, again, a quasi-legal investigation into Caroline's affairs. And then when George becomes George IV in 1820, this gets even worse because George does not want Caroline as his queen in any way, shape or form. So, again, Stuart is pushed, is pushed very hard by London to really sort this divorce out and get the evidence available. He's being pushed by the Austrians, who don't want to be involved too much into this, but they are actually given quite a lot of help. And he's also having to liaise with his own agents in Milan as well. So you've got the high European political diplomat against Stuart, basically, to put a better word, the rake mucker, the sort of mucking up, getting all this muck to do the Princess of Wales, get to secure this divorce. So it's a really bizarre career, really, in the 1810s and 20s.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, because he's not doing it himself, but this, it does create this image of sort of Charles Stuart, high diplomat by day, see private investigator by night.
yes, Stuart PI, absolutely, absolutely, and it's a role again which hasn't really been highlighted in many of the histories of the period, and I think he escapes a lot of the attention at the Queen's trial. So Queen's Attorney General Henry Broome certainly knows what's been going on, but it seems anyone outside the House of Lords doesn't really pick up on this. And I think because he's in Vienna, he tends to escape a lot of the criticism, which is directed especially at his brother, who comes in for some really virulent, you know, racist anti-Irish abuse at this time. And I think Stuart escapes. I think he's lucky to be kept in Vienna. And I do wonder sometimes if the government made sure he stayed, he was kept well away from proceedings.
Let's shift our focus to his brother. At this point, Castlereagh, he's become Lord Londonderry, and he's been Foreign Secretary now for he's nearing his first decade, the completion of his first decade as Foreign Secretary. And then you have this dramatic suicide. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain the impact of Castlereagh's suicide on his brother and how it changes his brother's career from that point onward.
Yeah, it's so sudden, you know, because as you say, Marquess of Londonderry or Castlereagh had been in office for a decade. He's at the height of his powers. You know, there are rumours that the Prime Minister, Lord Liverpool, is going to retire, although he always puts that off. And everyone sees Castlereagh as the natural turn, you know, the natural successor, really, to Lord Liverpool, should that ever happen. And there have been so many kind of theories and ideas about why Castlereagh took his own life in August 1822. And, you know, I don't want to play the role of medical historian. My partner's a medical historian, so I wouldn't dare do that. But, you know, it seems that through various times in the book that Stuart certainly suffers from quite severe depression, which he calls his blue devils at various times. And you know, you do wonder whether Stuart suffered from the same kind of symptoms. Again, you know, without the direct evidence, it's difficult to really say one way or the other. But it's quite reasonable that Castlereagh may have suffered from the same kind of symptoms. But again, I'm very loath to play medical historian two centuries on from that. But it's also, I think Castlereagh is a prodigious worker and works so much. So he's Foreign Secretary, and he's also leader of the House of Commons. So when you have so many of the cabinets sitting in the House of Lords, you have Castlereagh or Lord Londonderry, you know, still in the House of Commons, because obviously he's an Irish peer and doesn't have an automatic seat in the House of Lords. So basically, he sits in the House of Commons still. And I think he just comes too much, and it's. When Stuart's at home in the summer of 1822, you actually can read through his letters that Castlereagh's health deteriorates so rapidly, and you know, and it's just he becomes paranoid almost about people around him, paranoid about the Duke of Wellington, and you even have Countess Leven who worries, Countess Leven, the wife of the Russian ambassador, worrying that actually his fears about Wellington are being fed through Stuart's own sort of feelings towards Wellington. But again, there's not the evidence there to really say, you know, why that might have been the case. So when Castlereagh kills himself in August 1822, Stuart is back in Vienna, ready to attend a big European Congress at Verona. It basically, to me, his brother's death basically removes any kind of restraints on Stuart's character. Before that, you know, Stuart had always been enthralled to his elder brother, very much saw his elder brother, you know, as a great man, which he was. You know, a towering statesman of his time. I think Stuart was always keen to do his part to help Castlereagh as much as possible. But once Castlereagh dies, Stuart basically really does lose any kind of self-restraint. And when a family enemy, George Canning, who Castlereagh had fought a duel with back in 1809, was appointed as Foreign Secretary, Stuart just won't have it. He basically resigns in anger and fury. You know, and he basically throws away his entire embassy on the whole thing of Mr. Canning being appointed Foreign Secretary. And he then he then comes back to London, basically alienating virtually everyone in society and the political world, and I think destroys his own political career for basically what's fury at George Canning and what he sees as the political world's ingratitude towards Castlereagh and what he's done for Lord Liverpool's government over the last decade.
What I find interesting about this final phase of his life is you describe it. He basically destroys his career, and yet he spends the next, you know, nearly three decades trying to get back into politics. Was he not aware of what he had done, or did he think that with the passage of time and because of his stature that he could eventually reclaim a position in politics?
Yeah, I think sometimes I think a mixture of all of those. I think in the 1820s he spent his time alienating as many people as possible. You know, the king, the prime minister, the Duke of Wellington, etc. And then you know I think he wants to become someone who's politically very important. So he's now third Marquess of Londonderry. He's married for the second time. He marries Frances Anne Bain Tempest in 1819. So he's got her estates that he's a life tenant on in the northeast of England. So he's suddenly a very great statesman. He's got a lot of money coming in because Frances Anne has an heiress of £80,000 a year, these huge coal mining estates in Durham. So he is a great figure. He becomes a great Tory political host, but he just doesn't seem to realise that he almost regards a return to power as his due. You know, I'm Lord Londonderry. You know, I'm the brother of Castlereagh. He goes on about being the brother of Castlereagh quite a lot, which tends to irritate quite a lot of people in the 1820s. You know, going on about, you know, do you know who my brother was? And they said, yes, we know exactly who your brother was. And then when you think things couldn't get even, you know, couldn't get worse, you get the early 1830s and the Reform Act, where he then becomes the most, you know, unreformed Tory. You know, he won't see reform at all. So even though you've got moderate Whig statesmen saying, we think you'd be a great asset to the cause, he basically goes absolutely sort of crazy, saying, no, I'm not, you know, I won't have reform of any kind whatsoever. So this is paradox there. He seems sensible in terms of what's happening in European affairs. For example, he warns about the dangers of ultra-royalism in France, but seems completely blind about the dangers of ultra-Toryism in Britain, that, you know, it could lead to revolution. So, you know, he's completely out on the limb. He's seen as so extreme, you know, that he's up there with the King's brother, Duke of Cumberland, who's seen as another sort of ultra-Tory of his time. And then when you get revolutions, you know, which see the Russians are temporarily thrown out of Poland in 1830-31, he sides with the Russians because he's unusually quite a Russophile as well, which is quite unusual for the sort of British aristocracy. So most sympathies in, for example, in Paris and London would be with Poland. His sympathies were with the Emperor Nicholas I. So again, he's seen as an unreformed Tory at home, a friend of tyrants abroad. And as time goes on, he just doesn't seem to be able to change his ways, and he doesn't see the damage he's done to his career until about 1839, when he actually writes to a former political opponent and actually admits, actually, my mind hasn't been very flexible, and I've probably gone on too much about my brother's memory and not changed in the way that he would have been able to do, because, you know, he had the better political mind than I have. But it's not as if he changes then. He then continues still to alienate people. And as you say, he's after various jobs. He wants to be ambassador to France. He wants to be ambassador. He wants to be Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. And he's basically told time again, no, you can't have them. And when Victoria comes to the throne in 1837, it's just carries on being just as bad, because she comes to regard Lord Londonderry as a very dangerous individual who should not be employed in any kind of position whatsoever. I think she says it would be injurious to the public service to employ the Marquess of Londonderry.
And yet there he is, as late as the early 1850s, still, you know, seeking positions. At this point, it's more about status and honor than it is about necessarily political power. But it's just fascinating to think about how he, you know, even at that point, we're talking, you know, this, it's been 2 decades since the Napoleonic War. It's been 15 years since he left. He last served in a post. And that these revelations are coming in, and yet 15 years after that, he's still there, you know, sort of, you know, pounding on the door, you know, basically saying, you know, I want my due.
Yeah, and he's also very, you know, he's very much keen for his, you know, for his eldest son from his first marriage to get his due as well. You know, so he's always pestering people for positions for his eldest son. Back in 1822-23, he pesters people for a peerage, for an earldom, for on behalf of the eldest son of his second marriage. So he's very keen to sort of see himself as a great statesman with a dynasty in Ireland, a dynasty in Britain, and he wants the honours and the perks that go with that. But he's quite happy to turn down, for example, a return to the Austrian embassy in the 1840s, as you know, he sees that as a personal insult. It's like, no, I'm not going back there. I want to be ambassador to France. But he's not going to be employed as ambassador to France because he's not seen as the right person for the job, but, you know, by the people who give those positions away at that time. But you're right, in the 1850s, he has a furious row you know, with his brother-in-law, Lord Hardinge, because he wants to be, you know, he wants a position of honour, like, for example, being Master General of the Ordnance. But he's simply not going to get that because, you know, no one is going to employ him. It's been, as you say, three decades on from when he, you know, from when he was last actively involved in high European affairs. And during that time, he's not really been involved in anything at all.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, I'm kind of between projects at the moment. So I'm kind of toying with the idea of writing on George the Fourth and really trying to basically tease out more on his character. Obviously, we have the anniversary of his accession to the throne next year. And there's been a lot of renewed interest in George the Fourth. So I'm kind of thinking along the lines of a sort of popular biography of George the Fourth. But watch this space. It's still, I'm still thinking about that, but I think it would be, that would make a really good next project.
It would be very interesting and very much, and it builds nicely off of what you've written about here with Charles Stuart.
Yes, thank, yes, I think so. I think George IV gets very underrated as well. I think, you know, and there are key times when he's an important influence. For example, when he becomes regent in 1811, he doesn't, you know, when he gets full power in 1812, he doesn't, for example, throw over the British war effort and throw out the minister. So he I think he gets a very bad kind of reputation as a sort of a man who does nothing. But for most of his life, George III won't let him do anything. So I'm really keen to try and tease out more about the king's character.
Well, reader Payne, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
No, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much, Mark.